Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the possibility that Venezuela will be laying out the red carpet for Edward Snowden, and go to Caracas, Venezuela to speak with David Smaldi, a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, who has taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. We will discuss the likely impact of Venezuela taking in Snowden at a time when there were signs of improvement in relations between the U.S. and the Maduro government. Then we will speak with an expert on the Arab media, Marwan Kredi, a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Arab Television Industries. With Al Jazeera banned from press conferences by Egyptian journalists and the Saudis Al Arabiya, the mouthpiece for Egypt's Salafist Al Nour party, we will discuss the outside influence of rival Saudi-backed and Qatari-backed TV networks in shaping and covering the coup underway in Egypt. Then finally, following today's car bombing in a Hezbollah stronghold of Beirut, we will look into the possibility of the proxy war next door in Syria spreading into Lebanon in retaliation to Hezbollah's brigades joining in the Syrian civil war. Beirut-based freelance writer and editor Emily Dish Becker joins us to discuss whether the Free Syrian Army is making good on its threat to bring the war home to Hezbollah. Joining us now is David Smaldi, who is a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela, and a professor of sociology at the University of Georgia. His research focuses on social movements, human rights, and culture in Venezuela. Professor Smaldi has researched Venezuela for the past 20 years and has lived there for a total of 10 years, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. He is currently working on a book, Venezuela's Transition to Socialism, Politics and Human Rights Under Chavez, and he joins us from Caracas, Venezuela. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Smaldi.
Thank you for having me.
And it appears that Venezuela is about to lay out the red carpet for Edward Snowden, a Russian lawmaker, Alexei Pushkov, who's been pretty much the point man on releasing information from the Kremlin, said basically that this is his last chance and that Snowden will go to Venezuela. That tweet was immediately deleted, but at this point, I guess it's the best information we have. What's the local reaction to the possibility that Venezuela will host this American fugitive?
Well, like everything else in Venezuela, it's very polarized. People that support the government think that it's great, think that it really gives Venezuela profile and fits in with their revolution. People who oppose the government see it as a way to sort of distract people from all the other problems that are going on in the country, such as the contested elections in April, as well as economic shortages that have been affecting the country over the past month.
But it seems that this will impact. I mean, I think one can predict that this will impact U.S.-Venezuelan relations negatively. Not that they've been particularly good, but there was some indication that they were improving with a recent meeting between Secretary of State Kerry and Venezuela's foreign minister at a conference in Guatemala. What's your understanding of whether relations were improving?
Well, I think clearly they were improving. You know, there was a high-level meeting, the highest-level meeting since Chavez met Obama in 2009. This meeting was between Venezuela's foreign minister, Elias Jaua, and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, and this was in the context of the OAS meetings in Antigua, Guatemala. And they came up with an agreement that they were going to work on a common agenda and work towards exchanging ambassadors again between the two countries. And so that was very, very positive, and there's been some progress since then. And so clearly that progress is going to be on hold and could significantly deteriorate. You know, this is something that's clearly going to be an affront to the United States and clearly an affront to the, you know, warming relations. And so I think, you know, I'm not sure that it's going to necessarily go too far beyond that. I think for Venezuela, for the United States, the optics of this whole case are not good. It's not really good public relations anywhere. You know, the fact that the United States, you know, these revelations, the United States has been spying on its own citizens and in other countries, and now they're chasing this person around the world, it just doesn't look all that good. And so I'm not so sure that, you know, that once he gets asylum in Venezuela or elsewhere, the U.S. is going to continue to push on this. They might just prefer to let it sort of die and go away.
So do you think, David Smaldi, that what happened to the airplane of President Evo Morales of Bolivia that was forced down in Vienna recently, do you think that changed Maduro's mind? If he was wanting better relations with the United States, it seems that he's reversed himself, and I suspect that that might be a part of it.
Yeah, I think clearly that was fundamental. That was a fundamental shift. I think what happened there clearly made this into an issue, at least in the region, at least in Latin America, made this an issue of national sovereignty and independence vis-a-vis the United States. It made this a much broader issue rather than just being sort of far left. It came to be much more of a centrist type issue. And I think, you know, Maduro would have the support of virtually all Latin American presidents on this. I think beyond that, you know, just in the past couple of days, the revelation that the U.S. has been spying on Brazil as well makes it even more so. You know, now they have Brazil, who previously had denied Snowden's asylum request. Now they have Brazil much closer on their side and upset about what's been going on. And so I think that really did sort of change the balance, because before that, Maduro had been giving quite ambivalent statements. You know, the very first day on the 23rd of June that it looked like Snowden might be coming here, the Maduro government didn't say anything for about 36 hours. You know, in support or against or whatnot, and that was why during that day suddenly it appeared like he was going to go to Ecuador. And later that week, Maduro also said, well, if the United States wants extradition of Snowden, then they should extradite Luis Posada Carriles, which is a person that is in the United States that Venezuela has long wanted the United States to extradite. I mean, that kind of made it look like Snowden would be a bargaining chip. That wasn't all that inviting either. But it was after that Evo Morales flight that I think really shifted the interpretation of this case.
And again, I'm speaking with David Smaldi, who's a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela, and a professor of sociology at the University of Georgia. His research focuses on social movements, human rights, and culture in Venezuela. And Professor Smaldi has researched Venezuela for the past 20 years and lived there for a total of 10 years, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. He is currently working on a book, Venezuela's Transition to Socialism, Politics, and Human Rights, under Chavez, 2008 to 2012, and he joins us from Caracas, Venezuela. So it would seem, though, that given what happened to Evo Morales's plane being forced down and the fact that the Europeans, who supposedly at the time were upset by revelations of U.S. spying on the EU, they nevertheless seemed to cooperate with the U.S. in that regard, assuming that the orders came from the U.S., which I think is a reasonable assumption, that would mean, I take it, that Snowden is going to get out of Russia in a very circuitous route, isn't he? He's going to have to fly from Russia probably to Iran, and then from Iran maybe to South Africa, and then from South Africa to Brazil, and from Brazil to Venezuela. Is there any discussions about what route he may take?
No, I mean, I've only seen the same thing everybody else has seen. Is that, you know, the Washington Post had an article today that showed five possible routes. None of them were very desirable because they all required close to 7,000 miles of flying without, stopping for fuel. And so all of them are dangerous. All of them are undesirable. It's not clear. I don't know what's going to happen with that. I mean, I think, you know, one possibility is what has happened with Julian Assange, you know, who has been in the Ecuadorian embassy in Great Britain for over a year. I mean, Snowden could always end up going to the Venezuelan embassy in Moscow and staying there however long it takes. I don't know. I don't see any really good ways for him to get to Venezuela. I mean, I think the fallout of the Evo Morales grounding, I think, certainly took aback some of the European countries, so it might be a little bit different for them to, you know, deny airspace to a commercial flight. Maybe they'll make a judgment that they can risk it. I'm not sure. It's not at all clear how this will actually work out.
Well, that would be, of course, the Cuban flights from Moscow, which go through European and U.S. airspace.
Right.
But You know, the same Russian official whose tweet seems to be the only evidence that we have that Snowden may be on his way or want to go to Venezuela, that the Russian official Pushkov joked that if Snowden doesn't find shelter in Venezuela, he'll have to stay in Moscow and marry Anna Chapman. And that's, of course, the famous red-headed Russian spy who was among those Russian sleeper agents. And she was deported a couple of years ago from the United States. But apparently this Anna Chapman tweeted the other day a marriage proposal to Snowden. She's 31 years old and he just turned 30. So a match made in heaven. Right.
Well, there you go. Yeah, it might work out.
So, but just returning to the more serious aspects of this, assuming that, just in the last couple of minutes here, Davis Marley, assuming that Snowden shows up in Venezuela, already members of the Congress here are talking about punishing Venezuela with trade sanctions. What's the discussion down there, the price that they're going to pay?
Well, yeah, as I said when we started the interview, like everything in Venezuela is polarized. And so, you know, clearly people in the opposition would like some kind of, you know, strong U.S. response. The government hasn't really discussed it. I mean, I think, you know, the thing is what Venezuela sent the United States is oil. And you know, suddenly cutting off one part of, you know, the U.S. oil supply would affect prices and I think would not be a very popular policy. I'm sure that there's going to be legislators in the U.S. pushing for that, you know, especially the sort of the legislators or the anti-Castro legislators. I don't think it's going to get that far, personally. I think, you know, once Snowden has asylum somewhere, you know, I think the U.S. will probably back off somewhat. They'll make some noise, but then kind of back off and move on because I think they don't really want to draw too much more attention to this case than they have to.
So is anybody talking about the irony that Snowden, and who's obviously in cahoots with WikiLeaks, that the irony that the so-called WikiLeaks, which is all about, supposedly all about press freedom, that their charge is going to end up in a country that's just closed down the last opposition television station?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of ironies. I mean, I think even more pointed ironies are that the state television network frequently on some of their shows will put phone calls that have been tapped and analyzed them on national television. Just recently, just in the past couple of weeks, there was a recording of an opposition legislator talking to a private conversation with one of her former professors, and that somehow was taped as well, and they never explained it. They put that on national television. And so those are directly the type of things that Snowden is talking about and that have happened here in Venezuela. So there's a certain irony here. Of course, on all sides, there's lots of irony and there's lots of hypocrisy. But I think, you know, in the best case, who knows, maybe this will generate a little bit more discussion in Venezuela about some of these practices.
Well, David Smiley, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David Smiley, who's a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela, and a professor of sociology at the University of Georgia. His research focuses on social movements, human rights, and culture in Venezuela, and Professor Smiley has researched Venezuela for the past 20 years and lived there for a total of 10, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. He is currently working on a book, Venezuela's Transition to Socialism, Politics and Human Rights Under Chavez, 2008 to 2012. And he joined us from Caracas, Venezuela. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the role of the press in the coup in Egypt.
Porque está viejo y cansado, pero no se dan de cuenta que un corazón amarrado, cuando le sueltan las riendas, es caballo desbocado. Una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a faceta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran pasas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Marwan Crady, who is a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics and was the founding director of the Arab Media and Public Life Project at American University. His books include Hybridity or the Cultural Logic of Globalization, Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marwan Crady.
Good evening. Thank you.
And it seems that television has played a huge role both in the original revolution in Egypt 2 years ago and the current coup underway, in as much as, for example, just yesterday, Al Jazeera was ejected from the official press conferences held by the interim government with the urging and applause of their fellow journalists. And meanwhile, of course, Al Arabiya, the Saudi-owned channel, is acting as a kind of spokesperson for the Al Nur, the Salafist party. So it's hard for me not to separate the media from politics in what's happening in Egypt.
You're absolutely right. There's obviously a national political struggle going on between the supporters of the deposed President Morsi from the Muslim Brothers and the interim government, which was put in place by the military. And you can see the regional alignment with, you know, Saudi Arabia was among the first to congratulate Egypt on the change, on the deposing the president. And when the Saudis congratulated the new government in place, or the new authorities, or the change of the guard, so to speak, everybody knew that there was something going on in regional politics. Qatar was very, very supportive of the Muslim Brothers. The Saudis seemed to have taken advantage of the new, young, untested ruler of Qatar to support what's going on, and the media obviously reflect that. Actually, what I've been hearing from Egypt is that it was initiated, that asking the director, the head of the Bureau of Al Jazeera in Cairo to leave the room was initiated by the journalists, not by the interim government. And other journalists who were present refused to participate in the press conference until the Bureau chief left the room. And so there's very, very strong feelings against Al Jazeera in Egypt today. Al Jazeera has been very supportive of Morsi, of the deposed president, of the Muslim Brothers. And during the last few days, Al Jazeera did something that infuriated many Egyptians. It opened its microphone to people who were calling the Egyptian army by things like the Al-Sisi brigades, basically mimicking the way that the national armies and the regime armies in Syria were basically diminished by being called militias or brigades of so-and-so. And that really angered a lot of people, and I think that's why the vitriol towards Al Jazeera really went up a notch or two in the last couple of days.
And, of course, prior to this press conference, the offices were burned. So it would seem that the Egyptian people and if Egyptian journalists want Al Jazeera out of the press conferences, the feeling must be pretty pervasive, at least amongst those who do not support the Muslim Brotherhood. And after all, there were 22 million signatures on a petition asking for Morsi to leave.
Absolutely. And so, you know, there's very strong feelings against Morsi, although the technicalities of, you know, whether this was a coup or not is a different story. Nonetheless, he was a democratically elected president, so there's very strong feeling on both sides. But the other thing is that Al Jazeera really capitalized on the Egyptian revolution. They also launched, if you recall, the Al Jazeera Live Egypt, which was a public affairs channel that basically focused on Egypt. Well, what also happened in the last few days, several people working in that channel resigned. One of them very publicly on Facebook saying, "We're resigning because we object to the way the channel is covering Egyptian affairs." So it's become very, very controversial, as if Al Jazeera has become one of the big hot potatoes in Egyptian politics.
Well, by extension, of course, that means Qatar is. And you were mentioning earlier the ascension of the younger king, the son of the emir who just stepped down. I mean, everybody talks about Qatar punching above its weight, both in supporting the rebels in Syria and the influence that they've had through Al Jazeera. It seems like it's backfiring in Egypt. Is the son trying to distance himself from the father in terms of what appears to be unqualified support for the Muslim Brotherhood?
I don't believe so. It does seem that on this aspect, just like on other aspects of Qatari foreign policy, the son, all the signs indicate that the son will follow in the footsteps of his father. But I think what has been going on, the Saudis have never really loved the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood really offers an alternative model of Islamic governance than the one that exists in Saudi Arabia. So it is seen as a threat. If you look at the last year or so in the United Arab Emirates, which mirrors the Saudi perspective, they have been basically hunting down suspected members of the Muslim Brothers in the UAE with accusation of plotting to, against the government and coups and things of that sort. So I think there are major political forces, especially the Saudis, who have never been very happy with the Muslim Brotherhood being in charge in Egypt. After all, you know, the Saudi king made it very clear that he was devastated by the fact that his friend, who he called his friend, Hosni Mubarak, was deposed in the January revolution. So this is a continuation of regional politics, in a sense. And it, of course, Egypt is a major loss for the Qataris, and we don't know yet what's going to happen, but it does seem that the Saudi role is on the ascendant. And you can see this with the way, for instance, Al Jazeera is treated very differently than Al Arabiya,
which is the Saudi owned channel.
Yes, the Saudi channel, the Saudis do support the Al Nur party, which is a Salafi party in Egypt, whose basically point of view is quite similar to the dominant clerical political orientation in Saudi Arabia. And the Al Nur party, it has transpired, was part of a coalition of, you know, the liberals, the Tamarud group that basically came up with the petition and gathered the signatures, and they agreed to topple the Muslim Brotherhood government. They agreed to topple the president. So Al-Nur was part of these deliberations and actions against the elected president, ex-president of Egypt. But then they stepped back when the name of Al-Baradei was proposed to be, you know, the interim vice president or prime minister. I mean, all these things were in flux until very recently. Then the Al-Nur party stepped back and objected against Al-Baradei, who they seem to believe is too liberal for their taste. So Egyptian politics is very much in flux. It's very clear that there are shifting regional alliances. I do suspect that the Saudi role is growing. The Qatari role has diminished. But the verdict is not yet out. It's a situation that's very much in flux. We don't really know what's going to happen, and I think the media will continue to reflect that.
And again, I'm speaking with Marwan Crady, who's a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics and was the founding director of the Arab Media and Public Life Project at American University. And his books include Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. So when the actual coup was announced, of course, with the General Sisi, the head of the army, standing next to him were representatives of the Al-Nur party. So the Saudi fingerprints are definitely on this coup, if indeed it turns out to be a coup, in a reactionary sense. A lot of Egyptians I've spoken to over there, including some of the organizers of the original revolution, just told me a couple of days ago that, you know, the police, of course, never forgave the liberals for the revolution. They've sabotaged Morsi by simply not doing their job. They're probably behind the killing of these supporters of the Brotherhood. And there's a lot of people in Egypt who feel that the role of Saudi Arabia is quite prominent in all of these people, including the acting head who spent about 10 years in Saudi Arabia, the person now in charge. And as you pointed out earlier, the Saudis do not want this alternative model of the Muslim Brotherhood to get any traction. And they essentially want the democratic experiment in Egypt to fail. I mean, that's a fair assessment, isn't it?
Yes, it is a fair assessment. But I think in terms of the media scene, the other force, the other source of contention during the rule of Morsi is Egyptian artists, actors and soap operas, singers, movie stars, for the most part were up in arms against what they call the Ikhwanization of the media or the brotherization of the media, which is a kind of quote-unquote purification campaign to bring the media basically closer to the image of a kind of a good, virtuous Muslim society, the way the Muslim Brotherhood believes. And if Al-Nur is going to be ascendant now, I think this is going to be another source of contention, where media, especially television, will continue to play a dominant role, because Al-Nur is as conservative in terms of a kind of a moralistic, socially moralistic view on society, if not more so than the Muslim Brotherhood. So I believe we're still going to see a lot of culture wars, so to speak, parallel to the political struggles going on in the next phase, if the Islamists of Al-Nur, who are close to the Saudis and who have this moralistic view on culture, on public culture, on media, do in fact prevail and do manage to get a share of power in whatever government is going to see the light soon.
Well, but the other player, and the dominant player, of course, is the army. And then you have the recalcitrant Mubarak-era police, and you also have the intelligence services.
Yes.
Because under Mubarak, Egypt was a bit like East Germany was with the Stasi. God knows how many people they had on the police payroll. And those people, of course, have essentially sabotaged the Brotherhood's government from day one. But the people who've really, I think, done more damage to on a daily basis to the Brotherhood, apart from the fact that Morsi himself is boneheaded and King Abdullah of Jordan described him as exceedingly stupid, he, of course, has made a mess of things. But my understanding is that the real culprit undermining democracy and the Morsi government has been the old guard media, the Mubarak area media, who have just been from day one saying the sky is falling, since the revolution.
Yes, I mean, that is true to some extent. So there are many people who were unhappy with the ascendance of the Muslim Brotherhood, and that includes some of the media owners. Don't forget that in the late Mubarak years, the government allowed the creation of privately owned satellite television channels. For the longest time, Egypt is a big developmentalist state where the state controlled all the means of communication, at least the electronic ones. In the last few years of under Mubarak, they allowed the creation of these privately owned channels that were owned by people who were very close to the regime, and in many cases close to Gamal Mubarak, Hosni Mubarak's son. And these obviously have people with certain political sympathies. Many of them do reflect the prevailing opinion in the media industries, in culture, in the arts in Egypt, that tends to be vehemently anti-Brotherhood. So they were crying wolf from day one, absolutely. And they never really accepted the legitimacy of the government. I mean, people like Bassem Youssef, who basically made a career out of mocking Morsi, and Morsi was very, very, very good source for comedy and ridicule. What many observers are saying now, let's see if these people will be able to mock the new government in the same way. And so there is a sense that maybe the remnants of the Mubarak regime are coming back, but nobody knows what exactly is going on. The media played a role, the police played a role, the armed forces remain a decisive, if not the decisive actor in the situation. And the situation is still very fluid.
Well, we don't have to look back very far to the consequences of the private television network in Egypt that broadcast that incredibly divisive and scandalous film that was made out here in Los Angeles by some Coptic Christian criminal that nobody in the world's ever seen, except it became, of course, celeb amongst religious fundamentalists. It led to riots in front of the American embassy, and then, of course, by extension, led to the deaths of the American diplomats in Benghazi. So that, I think, is an example. I mean, the decision to run that heretofore unknown film was made, obviously, by the owner of that private television network.
Yes.
In Egypt.
Yes, and this is what happened when a very strong state, a dictatorship, collapses. At a time when starting a media operation, whether a television channel, a newspaper, has become cheaper and cheaper, easier with the existence of a large class of people who are qualified media workers. Immediately after the revolution, you have a kind of mushrooming of television channels, many of them religious, many of them quite sectarian. And what these do, of course, they compete for public opinion. They compete for public. They try to mobilize their own core publics, and they try to gain other followers. And the best way to do that is by putting on the air these very sensationalistic, attention-grabbing films and videos, and that's why talk shows became very important, comedy became very important, because these are the kind of things that attracted people's attention at a time when everybody was struggling to mobilize a public and turn it into a political force.
So at this point, what's your sense, not so much as a media analyst, Marwan, but as a political analyst, of will there be a backlash in favor of the Brotherhood because of the brutal treatment of just gunning down those kids, which is, I think, pretty much at the hands of the shadowy police forces and intelligence people that I had the other day on Jawad Nabulsi, one of the leaders of the original revolution, and he was saying he talked to the Brotherhood people and said, you know, you've got to put these guys on trial. You've got to bring them to account for what they've done. And if you don't, they're going to come back to bite you. And now they're moving against the Brotherhood, and but sooner or later they'll move against the liberals too, right?
Absolutely, and this is—I think this is a very big problem. You know, of course, the worst-case scenario that everybody fears is the Algeria scenario, where you have the military deposing a democratically elected Islamist government, and then a civil war ensues, and hundreds of thousands are killed in blood and gore for years. This hasn't happened yet, although, you know, the number of dead yesterday suggests that this could, more events, more incidents like that could trigger a protracted bloody battle. But if you put yourself in the shoes of the Muslim Brothers, they ran for elections. By all accounts, the elections were as clean and as competitive and as fair as they could have been under the circumstances. They won the elections. They were given only a year to rule. Now, on the one hand, yes, Morsi made many, many mistakes. The economy is falling apart. He didn't do much, or maybe couldn't do much. He didn't really bring about civilian control over the police and armed forces. All these mistakes, he was bullheaded. He wasn't into including opponents in decision-making and all those things. Yes, that's right. But he was still democratically elected. And I think a coup of that sort could really give credence to the Islamist claim that no matter what they do, they will not be allowed to rule. Their opponents would say, you know, the one man, one vote, one time, that once they take over, these Islamist party will never allow democracy. Well, what we see happen is we see other forces not allowing the Muslim Brothers to rule democratically. And I think that is a problem.
Well, that's the Algerian model, right? I say that's the Algerian model.
That's the Algerian model. That's the worst case scenario that I'm afraid might happen. I don't know what the odds are, but I think the only solution is to really include the Muslim Brothers in the decision making. The way the coup happened, you know, it's this very old style coup where you had police and military people moving onto the television channels, all the media that was with the brothers, with the Muslim Brothers, shutting them down. And I'm afraid that those are the kinds of action that will trigger a backlash. If in the coming weeks we see the Muslim Brothers included some kind of a negotiated settlement where there is an acknowledgement on the one hand that there might not be a going back to Morsi as president, but on the other hand, as a democratically elected president, there was a popular mandate. There's a large section of the Egyptian population that supports this political party and this view of the world, that they should be included in the government. I'm afraid if that does not happen, chances of civil war occurring in Egypt will begin to grow again.
And if these elections happen and the Muslim Brotherhoods are included and it's fair as it was the last time round, although there was some, because of the nature of the runoffs, the socialist guy came in a very, very close second, close third. And it would seem that this might be an opportunity for the liberals and the original revolutionaries to get their act together, because if the Islamists are split between al-Nur and the Brotherhood, they should win.
Yep. Yes. And I mean, The problem is now al-Nur has shown its face as willing to make deals against other Islamists. So that's very clear. So we cannot assume that the two major Islamist political groups in the country will be united.
Right, but the Saudis will pour in boatloads of money as they did last time.
Yes, but if there are elections, I don't think a potential win by the Muslim Brotherhood can be dismissed. It could happen, and it might very well happen, even if al-Nur doesn't support them. It will be a very close election. That seems to be for sure. if it's clean, if it's transparent, if it's fair. Imagine if another Muslim Brotherhood president is elected. What would happen then? I think that's a question that's worth asking.
Sure. Well, just in closing, Marwan Crady, what is your sense then of the U.S. role or the lack of it? It seems to me that the U.S. in many ways, even though the men on the street in much of the Arab world see the Americans' conspiracy behind everything, and they even in Egypt have been showing posters of Obama with Morsi's beard superimposed,
yes,
saying that the Americans foisted the Muslim Brotherhood on us, which seems to be an absurd notion. Ann Patterson, of course, getting a lot of criticism. What's your sense of what the Americans can do?
Well, I mean, I don't know what they can do. Sometimes the best thing the U.S. government can do is to stay away from things, which, of course, it won't be able to because of the kind of the momentum of U.S. influence and the shifting alliances going on and all kind of geopolitical considerations. You have the Suez Canal. You have, Egypt is not a country that can be abandoned by the major power of the world, including the U.S. But I think what's funny is if you look at both pro-Muslim Brothers and anti-Muslim Brothers, if you look at the demonstrations, both sides had signs and photos accusing the other of working with Obama, accusing the other of being helped by the American. And so in many sense, the American government now is in a no-win situation. Whatever it does, it has to do, it cannot do it publicly. Everybody knows that the armed forces in Egypt have pretty tight relations with the U.S. After all, there's, you know, the Camp David Accord. A lot of money comes by way of Egypt to keep the peace agreement with Israel. And those are very important considerations and calculations in U.S. foreign policy. And so when the military says we're deposing the president, I don't think it's a conspiracy theory to consider that the U.S. might have played a role, maybe not an active role, maybe not a decisive role, but at the very least an acquiescent or supportive role in what happened. I think that's a very fair assessment that a lot of people are making. But the fact that both sides are accusing the other of working with the American doesn't bode well for the margin of maneuver that the U.S. government has at the moment.
Well, Marwan Crady, I thank you so much for joining us here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Marwan Crady, who's a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics and was the founding director of the Arab Media and Public Life Project at American University. His books include Hybridity or The Cultural Logic of Globalization, Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how the proxy war in Syria appears to be spreading to Lebanon. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Emily Dishbecker, who is a Beirut-based freelance writer and editor who has worked for Harper's Magazine, Der Spiegel, Die Zeit, and Al Akhbar English, among other publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Emily Dishbecker.
Thank you.
And this car bomb that went off in the Shiite neighborhoods of Beirut, of course, has echoes of a bomb that went off many years ago that was aimed at the head of Hezbollah, Sheikh Nasrallah, and this bomb apparently went off pretty much in that same area. Is this a portent of things to come in terms of the sectarian nature of this proxy war in Syria spreading into Lebanon if it hasn't already done so?
Well, the bomb that you're referring to, I think, is the 1985 car bombing in the same neighborhood, Bir al-Abid. But that targeted Fadlallah, who is an Ayatollah and is not actually a member of Hezbollah. They follow Khamenei in Iran, but he's often conflated with Hezbollah, even though he's not a member or even really affiliated with them. That was a bomb that killed 80 people and injured 200 civilians, and apparently was the work of the CIA, according to Woodward and a number of other people. It's sort of commonly known that that's the case. In terms of it spilling over from Syria, that's been happening for some time, but Lebanon has its own sectarian issues that precede what's happening in Syria. And now I think what's mostly happening is that the parties to the Syrian conflict, particularly the opposition and their backers, are trying to bring the conflict to Lebanon as sort of another front and pressure on Hezbollah, who are fighting in Syria, on behalf of the Syrian regime. So, yes, there's definitely an attempt, and that's quite overt, because the Syrian opposition, armed opposition, has said that they would bring the war home to Hezbollah, and the southern suburbs would be the place to do that, because that's considered sort of a secure area that Hezbollah controls, and any attacks there, you know, that's sort of a impact on morale would be high.
But the Lebanese civil war went on for some time. It was quite agonizing and incredibly brutal. And in many ways, it appears to have the same kind of, it seems to be the same kind of proxy war in terms of the players back then and now, right? With Saudi Arabia, Hariri, of course, was a Saudi citizen supporting one side, and Iran through Hezbollah supporting the other. So are we seeing the same thing in Syria?
Well, I think it's not the same thing, because there is the aspect of it having been a popular uprising against the rule of Bashar al-Assad, but there certainly is a proxy war on top of that, and that is increasingly, you know, there's almost, that's the main conflict in some ways. So it is similar to what happened in Lebanon. The brutality is certainly as extreme, if not more. And, yes, you have some of the same parties, although Qatar, of course, has played a major role in funding some of the armed opposition and being very involved, and they weren't players in the 80s. Their involvement on a regional level is very recent, and they're considered sort of, you know, amateurish almost, given how they've been handling the situation, arming groups that are considered terrorist organizations by the U.S., who are, you know, allies of Qatar, or at least their weapons have been, shipments and funding have been going to those groups, and it hasn't been going very well. So, in fact, now it looks like Saudi Arabia is taking the lead in supporting the Syrian opposition and rebels, and Qatar is sort of stepping back. But it is a very proxy war situation, more than any other current conflict in the region, certainly in the last, you know, since Iraq.
And again, I'm speaking with Emily Dishbecker, who is a Beirut-based freelance writer and editor who has written for Harper's Magazine, Der Spiegel, Die Zeit, and Al-Akbar English, among other publications. So given that the Lebanese civil war eventually ended, and it seemed so bleak and so intractable, is there a lesson there for ending this civil war in Syria?
Well, the Lebanese civil war, I don't know if one could say it ever really ended. Certainly there was an end to hostilities, but that was mostly, you know, an external decision. The Saudis decided that they would let the Syrians control Lebanon, and the Syrian army occupied Lebanon for 15 years after the end of the civil war, and the U.S. was fine with that. They gave the green light in 1990, and Hariri was made prime minister, and he paid off all the warring factions. And but, you know, Lebanon has not really gotten over that sectarian aspect at all. It's certainly beneath the surface and has been bubbling up in the last few years, and that's also had its proxy elements, because the Saudis fund Hariri and pour a lot of money into the elections in Lebanon, and the Iranians support Hezbollah. So that's sort of, we would hope for Syria that they would not have a Lebanese outcome. They deserve better, surely.
Well, of course, and Hezbollah apparently was behind the bombing of Hariri that killed him. So the beat goes on.
The beat goes on. Well, that is, they have not, the trial has not started. We'll see what the evidence
The UN has the evidence, but Hezbollah apparently has a lot of influence in Beirut. So I don't think there's much doubt about who did it. It's just a question of whether you'll ever pin it on the perpetrators in Hezbollah.
I guess it really depends who you ask on that. I mean, I think that a lot of people in Lebanon don't believe that it was Hezbollah because it was first pinned on Syria. I mean, of course, now Hezbollah's relationship with the Syrian regime is sort of, you know, they're militarily involved in a much more direct way than we've ever seen. So some people think that cast doubt on their relationship 7 years ago or 8 years ago, but Hezbollah were not so close to the Syrian regime always. In fact, they were antagonistic towards them in some aspects. So a lot of people don't believe that Hezbollah killed Hariri because of the back and forth in accusations and leaks and things like that. But we'll have to see what happens.
Well, I did speak to one of the people on the investigation, which is being conducted by the United Nations, and apparently they used metadata from the telephone companies, which is similar to what, of course, Edward Snowden here released in the United States about the NSA's spying on American citizens through this program called PRISM. And it was apparently quite similar in a sense that they got the metadata and they were able to, through algorithms, to trace the calls back to these Hezbollah operatives. So what the man on the street believes, and of course there are all kinds of conspiracy theories throughout the Middle East, is somewhat different from what the evidence might indicate.
Sure. And I think part of the tribunal's purpose in setting it up was to establish some sort of faith in the rule of law, although establish might not be the right word, but to strengthen the Lebanese judiciary and all these things. So the outcome is not only about one guy's murder. That would be a lot of, you know, money and destabilization as a result of it just being a murder investigation. There's a larger aspect and what needs to happen from this that was the main purpose of the tribunal as well. So it does matter what people believe. If people thought that the process had integrity, it would certainly be a different outcome, I think.
So in terms of, obviously, the Lebanese have seen so much bloodshed that they don't want to have a repeat of it, and it seems like the situation next door in Syria, particularly the involvement of Hezbollah in propping up the military side of the Assad regime. And Iran, of course, apparently is helping out as well, and particularly in terms of money and arms. So do you think that somehow, and I don't know how, the Lebanese can avoid being sucked into this thing? I mean, clearly they've seen enough bloodshed. One of the arguments, of course, about this war that's going on in Syria is that at some point or other, the combatants just get exhausted, and that's when there's a chance for peace. And that certainly appeared of what happened in Lebanon as well. There was a certain exhaustion. So I guess two questions there. One is, are the Lebanese people so tired of war that they can sufficiently prevent it from happening again, or is there just too much pressure from outside players in this complicated proxy war next door?
I think you're right that the Lebanese overall do not want a war in Lebanon. And, of course, Hezbollah leader Nasrallah said in one of his speeches, I guess in May, that told the other Lebanese factions, addressing basically his adversaries, said, you know, go fight in Syria, don't fight in Lebanon. Which, obviously Syrians would have a problem with that too. But I think that there are efforts to contain the violence. There has been fighting in Lebanon continuously in certain parts. In the north, in Tripoli, there's fighting, you know, for the last few years, and that's been quite violent and destabilized. And then there was in the south, 2 weeks ago, there was fighting. There was a number of Lebanese army soldiers killed, and fighters from a Sunni cleric who you know, is anti-Hezbollah, Sheikh Asir. So there has been fighting, but people are very, do not want to get dragged into it. That's for sure. And I hope that they succeed.
Well, there's a colleague of yours in Beirut, Robert Fisk, who writes for the UK paper The Independent, recently was saying that there were several thousand Iranian troops that had just shown up. And my understanding is that in many ways, the deeper that Hezbollah and Iran get into, and some people have said that Syria could end up like Iran's Vietnam, and that may well be overstated. But do you get the sense that there is a deepening involvement of both Iran and Syria? Because it seems that Hezbollah and Iran and the Russians know what they want. They don't want Assad to fall. On the other side, the Europeans and the Americans and the Saudis and the Qataris seem to, at least on the American side, they seem to know what they don't want, but they don't know what they do want.
I think that's right. I think there is definitely a deepening involvement by the Iranians and by Hezbollah and certainly thousands of fighters from outside Syria. Foreign fighters are fighting on the side of the opposition against the regime. I think that the Iranians know what they want. And I think that one of the reasons that Hezbollah got involved was to show the West that it is more important for them to ensure that the regime survives than it is for the West to overthrow him, and they are willing to put more into that battle than the West is, which does not have a clear strategy, and certainly hasn't been, I would say, entirely successful. The Gulf Arab regimes that are backing the Syrian opposition against Assad's regime have been, doing a number of things to put pressure on Hezbollah, including threatening to expel any Lebanese who support Hezbollah. Obviously, lots of Lebanese, including Shia Lebanese, work in the Gulf and support their families by sending money back home. So there's been a lot of pressure. People have been expelled from the Gulf. Their visas have been revoked. There's been pressure in numerous ways, not only sending fighters and money and everything else. And, of course, there's also been fatwas declared by Sunni clerics who have said that it's a duty to go fight jihad against the Shia and to go fight in Syria. So that's there's been a huge escalation in terms of the stakes on both sides for the Syrian conflict. And we'll really have to see. It's not looking good.
Well, in as much as the U.S. doesn't seem to be certain about what to do, and you've got people like John McCain on the hawkish Republican side saying Obama's not doing enough and that they should have a no-fly zone and lob some cruise missiles at Assad, I would suggest that the people in the region who actually do know what they want are the Israelis. And even though Israel has struck a couple of times against Assad as a warning to Syria not to ship arms to Hezbollah, at least that's the stated purpose behind these strikes. Obviously, the Israelis, on the one hand, don't want, I'm assuming, they're intelligent enough not to want to turn to overtly go after Assad, because that would turn it into an Arab-Israeli war as opposed to a civil war between Syrians against Syrians. And, of course, the Assad regime was always argued that the rebels are all tools of America and Israel. So that would play right into their hands. But on the other hand, I imagine there are a bunch of Israeli generals who are still smarting from the inconclusive 2006 war against Hezbollah, who might well be tempted if Hezbollah is stretched and committed and sucked into a quagmire in Syria. Is that a possible scenario?
I think it's definitely a possible scenario, and I think it's the one real game changer at this point. The wild card is what the Israelis are going to do and what Israeli direct involvement, if they did that, what effect that would have, essentially, both for Hezbollah and how the fighters in Syria, the Syrian opposition fighters, would respond to that. So I really don't know what the result of that would be, but that would certainly, change things in a way that one can't really anticipate what the effect would be. I would also say about McCain and in general the idea of what the U.S. is policy or strategy is that there are a number of people in the region who think that, and I think also in the U.S. Government, that particularly, who are concerned about Israel's security, that a sort of Iran-Iraq war scenario in Syria where Hezbollah versus, you know, Al-Qaeda and its subsidiaries, various Takfiri groups fighting each other, is not such a bad thing, as long as there's sort of a balance between the two. And where the balance looks to have tipped towards the Syrian regime in the last month and a half, I think that's where you see, you know, it's one reason that the U.S. Has been talking about getting more involved, and they've also mentioned that. They said, well, there needs to be a balance achieved. I think French President Hollande spoke, you know, directly of achieving a balance, so not actually tipping the balance, but, you know, maintaining it. So there's a lot of cynicism about that, because clearly if they wanted to get involved, you know, in a way to end things, there would be a different policy than sending small arms and the stuff that's being considered now.
Well, if that, of course, is the Iran-Iraq war, is, of course, brings to mind Henry Kissinger's famous statement at the time about the Iran-Iraq war, it's a pity both sides can't lose. So you're suggesting that that may well be the U.S. strategy.
I think that it's a possibility. It certainly would explain how things have been going to some extent. And as I've said, this is something that a lot of people on both sides, ironically, believe, right? I mean, the rebels don't think that the U.S. wants to help them, and nor do the other side. Could they particularly claim that the U.S. has done all it can to support the rebels? So I think that people generally on both sides presume that the destruction of Syria is a given, and that the West won't stop that from happening.
Well, Emily Dish Becker, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Emily Dish Becker, who is a Beirut-based freelance writer and editor who has written for Harper's Magazine, Der Spiegel, Die Zeit, and Al-Akhbar English, among other publications. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Claire Goldsmith and Nick Garino. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.